Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. Let the record reflect the time is 2:03 p.m. Today we have present Representative Prox, Representative Wright. Online we have Representative Ruffridge, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Sumner, in person. The staff that will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, Johan Timmers and Dana Nichols with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Thank you for joining us today for an interim committee meeting in House Labor and Commerce. We have three items on the agenda today. We will start with an introductory hearing on HB 186, then move on to a first bill hearing on HB 115, and finally a second bill hearing on HB 100, a bill that we heard the last legislative session. Starting with HB 186, a bill sponsored by the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Representative Wright, did you have a motion? We're going to roll back. I think Representative Wright has a motion.
Chair Sumner, I move that we rescind action in adopting Amendment Number 9 from the November 16th House Labor and Commerce hearing on HB 119 cannabis tax.
Okay, without objection, the amendment. Precision on the
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, Representative Sadler. The amendment is before us. Is there objection to the amendment as before us?
I'll object, Chair.
Okay. There is objection. Is there discussion? Representative Carrick.
Chair Sadler. Amendment number 9 was withdrawn, I believe. I think the amendment, perhaps Representative Wright was trying to refer to, is number 8.
Brief at ease. I do have a copy of amendment number 9 here, and I will read it. So the committee members know what we have before us. It is page 1, line 10 through page 2, line 7, delete all material and insert section 2, AS 4361.010F is amended to read the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund is established in the general fund. In addition to the accounting under C of this section, the Department of Administration shall separately account for 25% of the tax collected under this section and deposit it into the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund. The Department of Administration shall deposit interest earned into the fund, into the general fund. Money in the fund does not lapse. And then striking, the legislature may use the annual estimated balance in the fund to make appropriations to the Department of Health for the comprehensive marijuana use education and treatment program established under AS 4429.020A. Representative Carrick, did you have anything further?
No, thank you. I'll remove my objection.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to maintain my objection to that. The purpose of that, my primary purpose is dedicating funds to a particular program. I think that each program competes on an annual basis with other programs that are out there, and we should make that decision every year to choose this program over that program. It's not necessarily the program itself. That is still there. The money can be appropriated to it. It's just not a dedicated fund. And I want to maintain that adherence to the constitutional principle.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Representative Prox. And reconsideration did pass. The amendment is before us again. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. And I just want to maybe have a brief moment of clarification, if possible. According to my records, we had either heard or passed amendment number 9. So this is new to me, but potentially we could make sure we're talking about the correct amendment.
Okay, Bree Cadiz. The reconsideration of amendment number 9 is not in order because amendment number 9 was never offered. Representative Wright, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My apologies. I move to rescind the action adopting amendment number 8 from the November 16th House Labor and Commerce on HB 119 cannabis tax.
Okay, without objection.
It's up for reconsideration.
The amendment is before us for reconsideration, and that is amendment number 8. Is there objection to amendment number 8?
I'll object in purposes of discussion.
Okay, Representative Prox.
You can read the amendment again, please.
Sure. Now we will read it in. It is page 1, line 10 through page 2, line 7, delete all material. Renumber the following bill sections accordingly. Page 3, line 9, delete AS43.61.010B. Insert AS43.61.010B through F and AS4429.020A14R. Page 3, line 15, delete sections 3 through 5, insert sections 2 through 4. Page 3, line 16, delete section 9, insert section 8.
Now, I just heard about this yesterday and hadn't a chance to think about it. But my objective is to delete the designated funding from the marijuana tax. And if this goes beyond that, then I didn't want to delete a program through this bill. So if it makes more sense to rescind this amendment, and then at some point we can talk about amendment 9.
And thank you, Representative Prox. I think that's well reasoned. So there is objection. We will call the roll on this amendment number 8.
Your line is unmuted.
Please call the roll.
Representative Prox. Representative Ruffridge?
No.
Representative Sadler?
No.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Carrick?
No.
Representative Fields? Chair Sumner?
And so with one yay and 5 nays, amendment number 8 has not.
Your line is muted.
And we will move on, starting with House Bill 186, a bill sponsored by House Labor and Commerce Committee. Last legislative session, we had a presentation on fraud in the construction industry, which sparked the interest in sponsoring HB 186. I'm now going to ask my staff, Deanne Metcalf, to come forward, put your name on the record, and please begin. Oh, and let the record reflect that Representative Sadler joined us, I believe it was 2:05.
For the record, Dion Metcalf, staff representative Sumner. I'll start with the sponsor statement, external analysis, before taking any questions, if that's okay with the
chair.
Thank you. In Alaska, the construction industry plays a vital role in our state's economy, employing hardworking individuals who contribute to the growth and development of our communities. While many employers treat their workers fairly, some engage in unfair practices that harm workers and the industry as a whole. Wage theft in particular remains a persistent issue, impacting countless workers who rightfully deserve fair compensation for their efforts. To address this problem, House Bill 186 proposes the creation of a volunteer labor compliance officer program aimed at promoting compliance with Alaska's labor laws, educating workers about their rights, and harnessing the power of community volunteers to ensure a fair and competitive construction industry. While efforts have been made to combat wage theft, the scope of the problem remains largely underreported. A report by the Alaska Public Interest Research Group revealed that Alaskan workers have recovered just over $2.1 million in wage theft compensation between 2012 and 2018. However, this likely represents only a fraction of the wage theft incidents, as many go underreported due to various barriers and a lack of adequate tools to measure uncompensated wages. The Department of Labor Workforce Development lacks the staff and resources necessary to handle the rising number of wage theft claims. State wage and hour investigators play a vital role in advocating for workers' rights, but they often face resource limitations when it comes to monitoring and enforcing labor standards comprehensively. The proposed volunteer labor compliance officer program represents an excellent opportunity to address these challenges by leveraging the expertise and commitment of trained volunteers. By partnering with the unions, community organizations, and other stakeholders, this program will enable us to effectively monitor compliance with labor laws, thus promoting a fair and level playing field for all employers, both union and non-union. The creation of a statewide volunteer labor compliance officer program will serve multiple purposes. The first being it will provide technical assistance and support. Contractors and subcontractors will receive technical guidance to ensure proper worker classification and adherence to Alaska's labor laws. Number two, it will empower workers. More workers will be educated about their wage-related rights, ensuring awareness of their entitlements. Third, it will leverage community volunteers. Authorized community volunteers will be trained to interview workers at work sites concerning wages, benefits, and hours, reducing the burden on government resources and fostering labor compliance. Number four, it will alleviate state budget pressures while enhancing labor law enforcement in Alaska's construction industry. The Volunteer Labor Compliance Officer Program will not only protect workers, but also contribute to the overall economic growth and development of our great state. By ensuring compliance with labor standards, we can prevent unfair competition resulting from unscrupulous employers who exploit workers and undermine responsible business. This will create an environment that encourages fair and ethical practices, fostering healthy competition and attracting businesses that prioritize the well-being of the workforce. In conclusion, we urge you to support and champion the passage of House Bill 186 to create a volunteer labor compliance officer program in Alaska. By doing so, you will demonstrate your commitment to the rights and well-being of workers, the promotion of fair business practices, and overall prosperity of the state. And then next, I'm going to read the sectional analysis. Section 1, add the new Article 2 AS 23.05, directing the Department of Labor Workforce Development to create a volunteer labor compliance officer program for said volunteers to inspect construction sites in order to document compliance with state labor laws. Department of Labor and Workplace Development through the Volunteer Labor Compliance Officer Program will ensure that the state has a roster of qualified individuals to inspect construction sites by providing the proper training, safety equipment, granting them the authority to enter a work site and inspect records outlined in AS 23.05.100. The department will also outline regulations for volunteers such as ID badges, required safety equipment, as well as specifying the insurance coverage needed by volunteers. Article 6, add new statutes to AS 23.05, outlining powers and duties of the volunteer labor compliance officers. These powers and duties include the ability to access and inspect the construction site on behalf of the department and initiate labor compliance investigations, require volunteers to visibly display the department-issued ID card and wear the required safety equipment on site. Email a report of the department, visit within 48 hours, document the officer covered by workers' compensation, and maintain the required confidentiality. A volunteer labor compliance officer is not allowed to be a state employee, issue citations, or enforce state labor laws. While conducting the investigation, the volunteer is not allowed to wear attire of any other organization other than the department, disparage the employer, organize or promote or display insignia for any other entity or organization, or perform any type of work outside the scope of the volunteer labor compliance officer while acting in the capacity of a volunteer labor compliance officer. Article 6 also adds statutes to AS23.05 outlining the department, the requirements of a potential candidate must fill, the volunteer labor compliance officer and the ability to permanently revoke volunteers at in certain instances. Section 2 provides an immediate effect date.
Thank you. Do any committee members have questions for Mr. Metcalf? Representative Fox.
I have a couple of questions. Well, if he can answer them, that's fine. If we want to defer to somebody else, I don't know if there's invited testimony that can answer these better. But you use the word wage theft, which implies that I'm not sure how that's working. It implies that somebody's walking in and taking something surreptitiously. And I'm not quite sure how that happens in this case. What are we talking about as far as when we refer to wage theft?
So I'm not sure if this is in every instance, but what I can tell you is when somebody is misclassified, there's certain things that outline their duties as an employee. And so if one person is classified as, a laborer one, somebody's classified as a laborer three. If you're classified as a laborer one, you have certain duties. Well, if somebody classified as a laborer three, you have different duties. So you can misclassify somebody and not have to pay them for what they're working outside of classification. So that would be one instance of wage theft. I would have to defer to one of our experts for the other instances.
Okay.
Right.
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, I was supposed to say too.
Yes, sir.
Does this apply to work sites that are working under a government contract, or which groups of employers would this apply to? Just government contract employees? I'm not familiar with how it works. Or is it any, like a private, if there's a collective bargaining agreement with somebody, I can see where this would be in there. But if there is no collective bargaining agreement, I'm not sure how this works.
Through the chair to Rep. Pratt. As I understand it, this would apply to work sites that were on government, ones with collective bargaining agreements and one without.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it applies to, well, how would we know? I'm sorry. Through the chair. How would we know, you use the example, labor one, labor two, labor three, how would we know in the case of somebody working without a collective bargaining agreement that there was some sort of designation?
Through the chair to Rep. Pratt. I don't have the answer for you right now, but we can get back to you in the next couple of days and answer that question.
Okay. And then finally, if we could get some more information. We got that report from the Department of Labor, which indicates there's relatively few complaints. That doesn't mean there isn't more problems. But if we could get more of an estimate on the scope of the problem, I would appreciate that.
We'll get back to you with that information.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We are going to table this discussion for when session starts and have our second bill hearing that will include invited testimony. Moving on to HB 115, a bill from Representative Crox. We set an amendment deadline for this bill, but because some of our committee members weren't present, I'm going to reopen the amendment deadline for Monday, January 8th, which will still put us before start of session. And we are looking to have also a hearing on this bill within the first week of session. Representative Crox, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin. For the purposes of time, please hold questions until the end, and please limit your presentation to 45 minutes if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of House Bill 115 is to enable naturopaths to practice to the scope of their training. Right now, they are trained as part of their certification from the naturopaths colleges to have knowledge of prescription drugs and doing minor surgery, which amounts to just in-office sort of procedures. They're not doing liver transplants or something like that. But they're trained, but they're not allowed to practice. They're not allowed to prescribe medications, prescription medications, and they have the qualification to know when it might be appropriate, when it's needed, and also to know the limitations of when it's not appropriate. And I think that we've been trying for 10 years, I think, to allow them practice, and the evidence suggests from other states that it works out pretty good in practice, that the naturopaths know the limits, understand the limits, and public safety is not an issue. And that there are some folks listed for testimony, and I think it would be better to let them come.
Okay, Representative Crox, you want us to move on to invited testimony this time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first we have Dr. Natalie Wiggins representing AKAND. Mrs. Wiggins, please put your name on the record and and begin. Thank you.
So I'm Dr. Natalie Wiggins. I'm a naturopathic doctor here in Alaska, in Anchorage. Good afternoon, Chairman Sumner, members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking time to hear testimony today on this bill. So yes, I'm here today representing the Alaska Association of Naturopathic Doctors in support of House Bill 115, and I hope to provide each of you with the information that will give you the confidence to also support the bill, as it's in the best interest of Alaskan residents, particularly as we grapple with the nation's highest cost of medical care. So as you're aware, the accessibility of medical care directly impacts its cost. Unfortunately, Alaska faces a shortage of medical providers, contributing to the expense of healthcare. Naturopathic doctors like myself are prepared to address this gap in our healthcare system, but our ability to do so is hindered by the current limitations on our scope of practice. House Bill 115 seeks to remedy this by aligning the scope with our training. To address any concerns about the safety of this bill, I'd like to highlight a few key points, beginning with our educational background. So each of the licensed naturopathic doctors in the state have completed a four-year bachelor's degree program, including pre-medical requirements, followed by a rigorous four-year doctoral program. Each of these programs are accredited under the Council on Naturopathic Medicine, under the U.S. Department of Education. We have extensive training that includes 140 hours of pharmacology and 1,200 hours of clinical training, which includes prescriptive management and instruction in minor office procedures. So these are superficial wound repairs, biopsies, things of that nature. This training is comparable with nurse practitioners, and it exceeds that of physician assistants, both of whom have prescriptive authority. Yet despite our comprehensive training, the current scope of practice restricts us from fully utilizing our skills. The proposed scope outlined in House Bill 115 mirrors that which has been safely used in other states. Personally, I practiced in Arizona for many years, where I did have a scope that reflected my training, knowledge, and competency. This included prescriptive authority with scheduled medications and the ability to perform superficial wound repair. While in Arizona, I provided clinical supervision to third and fourth year medical students at the Sonoran University, as well as to the nurse practitioners and physician assistants in my private practice. I served as next in command to my MD colleagues in the oversight of the physician assistants in my office, and I continue to take an active role in training the new nurse practitioners in my firm. Returning to Alaska from Arizona was a choice fueled by my love for this state and my desire to raise my kids here. But moving here meant that I had to give up my ability to practice medicine to the extent of my training, a disservice both to myself and the Alaskan residents I serve. So moving here didn't change my training. My knowledge didn't change. My competency didn't change. My ability to safely use prescriptive medications didn't change. Only my residence changed. The current limitations in Alaska forced me to refer my patients when they need medication. So while I was entrusted to provide instruction to physician assistants in Arizona, here I have to refer to them medication. So here I am entrusted to perform all other aspects of primary care. I evaluate and diagnose my patients. I order and interpret their labs and imaging. I perform necessary exams, and I formulate a course of treatment. Well, that treatment may include a need for prescriptive medication. Instead of me being able to manage that aspect of their care, something that I'm fully trained and able to do, I have to refer. This causes all sorts of challenges for my patients. So I'll illustrate this with an example. Let's say I have a concerned parent who brings in their child for an evaluation of their complaints of sore throat, headache, and fever. And I do an exam, I take their history, I do some tests, and this child comes back positive to stress. Well, at this point, this child needs an antibiotic. And even though I'm totally trained in utilizing that medication, I have to refer them. This causes a lot of difficulty for this parent who may not have another established provider that they can easily get their child into. So what ends up happening is now this child this parent is tasked with either taking their child to an emergency room, which, you know, this is a primary care issue. It's not an emergency room issue, where they have to go to an urgent care and see whoever the luck of the draw is there that they don't have an established relationship. So not only that, you know, this poor parent is trying to maneuver all of this while they're trying to also care for a sick child at the same time. So this all results in duplicative appointments for this child. It places burdens on the parent, both financially and in terms of their time. They may need to take more time away from work. It hampers their ability to receive continuous care from their established provider who they know and trust, and it contributes to a strain on an already strained medical system. I care deeply for my patients, and I don't like putting them in this position. Drawing from my experience in Arizona, it's not only evident that the expanded scope of House Bill 115 is not only safe, but it's essential for comprehensive patient care. To underscore the safety and efficacy of this bill, we need only to turn to numerous states where NDs have been trusted to use their training as prescriptive states. Examination of these states not only highlights the benefits to the overall healthcare system, but also reveals consistently positive safety practices. In summary, there are close to 45 licensed naturopathic doctors in this state, each appropriately trained to safely prescribe medications and perform superficial procedures. Voting in favor of House Bill 115 is not just safe, it's a crucial step in the right direction towards reducing healthcare costs and ensuring comprehensive and accessible care for Alaska residents. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Wiggins. Are there any questions from the committee members? Representative Sadler. Representative Sadler, I believe you're muted.
Thank you. Can you hear me now, sir?
Yes.
Great. I wasn't sure if the who's in charge of the meeting. Dr. Wiggins, thank you for your testimony. Just curious, during your clinical training, the training of a naturopath, you said there's 1,200 hours of clinical experience. During that time as a naturopathic a trainee, a physician, do they have to practice under any other healthcare professional supervision during that period of training?
Through the chair. Thank you for your question, Representative Sadler. So are you asking if different provider types like NCs or CEOs or nurse practitioners instruct?
No, through the chair, Dr. Wiggins, specifically you said that you laid out the education requirements and then also said there are 1,200 hours, I believe it's 1,200 hours of clinical experience. And my question is, during that time, is a naturopathic doctor or healthcare provider required to practice under any other healthcare provider's supervision or approval or monitoring?
Through the chair, yes. So, for example, I led the third and fourth year medical students at the Sonora University, so they were under my supervision while they were doing that portion of their training. So during clinical training, it could be led by an MD, medical doctor, CO, or an ND.
So it would be under the supervision or observation of an MD. Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. To the chair, thank you, Dr. Williams, for your presentation. And just a question on, when you were in Arizona, did you have any instances where you something was outside of your scope of work, you had to go to a different doctor or any instances like that?
Through the chair, thank you for your question, Representative Wright. So, yes, in Arizona, the prescriptive authority did not include chemotherapeutic agents, and so for management of cancer, by all routine.
Follow. Is it only for chemo situations, or is it any other?
Through the chair, you know, it's true in any type of primary care medicine that there's definitely times that we need to refer to other specialties to enhance the care for that patient. For example, if I have a patient has needs a ligament repair for a knee, refer them over to an orthopedic specialist. So the same would be true in Arizona as it is here. Never.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler, did you have another question?
Sorry, sir. Nope, I just didn't drop my hand. No, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Wiggins. Next up, we have Dr. Carrie Baldwin-Sayer, Director of Development, National University of Natural Medicine.
Yes, thank you.
We're online.
Can you hear me all right?
I'm on the record, and go ahead.
Hello, my name is Dr. Carrie Baldwin-Sayer, and I'm the, I've had an update to my title since my previous testimony. I'm the AVP of Advancement and Community Engagement at National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having me. I'm a licensed naturopathic doctor at the National University of Natural Medicine, and my testimony today is specifically intended to provide information about the education and training completed by naturopathic physicians and how that training is overseen and regulated by national accreditation organizations. First, licensed naturopathic physicians have attended accredited naturopathic medical schools. These entities that accredit these schools are recognized and overseen by the U.S. Department of Education. Our institution is overseen by both programmatic accreditors, which oversees a very specific program within the university, and also a regional institutional accreditor that accredits the entire institution. The accreditor that oversees the naturopathic medical program at our institution is the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education. And this entity sets the standards for curriculum delivery, performance outcomes, financial stability of the institutions, faculty qualifications, student services, and university governance to ensure that our graduates are well-trained and prepared for professional success. The accreditation process is rigorous. It requires annual reports, performance of self-studies, and regular site visits. Our university is also overseen by our regional accreditor, the NWCCU. And the NWCCU is the same accreditor to oversee our state's allopathic medical school, the Oregon Health Sciences University, as well as the University of Alaska. And I'm proud to report that we meet the same high standards as those prestigious institutions. Naturopathic medical programs are four-year graduate training programs. NUNM's program includes approximately 5,047 hours of education, including 1,254 hours of direct clinical training. This is comparable to the educational requirements of many other medical providers. Admissions requirements, as Dr. Wiggins spoke to before, include a bachelor's degree from an accredited college, as well as a list of science and social science prerequisites that is nearly identical to the prerequisites for any other MD or DO program in the country. The first 2 years of academic education consist of biomedical sciences and diagnostic training, including courses in anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, histology, embryology, microbiology, etc. This foundation in the human sciences is followed by an extensive study in diagnostic methods and procedures. This includes courses in physical examination, laboratory diagnosis, and diagnostic imaging. Success in mastering this material is measured by the Biomedical Science National Board exam, which our students take after their second year of education. The second 2 years of the program are focused on translating the basic science knowledge into clinical application. And these courses provide a framework for developing our graduates into primary care physicians and include cardiology, gastroenterology, gynecology, endocrinology, and many others. Concurrently, students take courses on disease management and prevention through the use of therapeutic modalities such as nutrition, lifestyle counseling, botanical medicine, pharmaceutical prescribing, minor surgical procedures, and more. The students receive hands-on clinical training in a variety of settings throughout the program with gradually increasing levels of responsibility for patient care. As I mentioned before, they complete 1,254 hours of direct clinical training, including working in a state-credentialed primary care medical home, serving mostly Medicaid patients with complex medical needs. And I do want to emphasize this because during their final year, which is almost 1,000 hours, where the bulk of their clinical training is concentrated, they maintain their own primary care patient load. They are supervised by an ND supervisor, but they have their own patient load. Additionally, students must pass 3 hands-on clinical examinations to be able to graduate. In addition to graduation from an accredited institution, to become eligible for licensure, all NDs must pass 2 national board examinations. So in summary, I want to highlight that the educational program of naturopathic medical colleges prepares our graduates to be competent, safe, effective healthcare providers who are able to assess the primary care needs of their patients, particularly in medically underserved states. They are trained to refer to specialty providers when appropriate. I would also like to point out that allowing NDs to have non-scheduled medication prescriptive authority and the ability to perform minor office procedures is a low-risk addition to their existing scope of practice in Alaska and is well within the confines of their training. The 2 most striking benefits of this are, first, keeping the cost to patients down by avoiding duplicative costs of multiple visits to both an ND and an MD in order to obtain a needed prescription or a minor procedure, as Dr. Wiggins mentioned. Secondly, the ability to write a prescription may directly reduce the risk of severe illness, potentially going untreated by not making a patient wait to have a second appointment with an MD to obtain that needed prescription. Dr. Wiggins gave a great example of that. We've been accomplishing these tasks in Oregon, Washington, Arizona, and elsewhere safely for decades. Thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate being here, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you. We'll move along to Dr. Clyde Jensen. Dr. Jensen, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Clyde Jensen. I have a PhD in pharmacology, and I'm currently a professor of pharmacology at the Osteopathic Medical School in Southern Utah. We also have campuses in Denver and in Billings, Montana. I've previously taught pharmacology in colleges of medicine, osteopathic medicine, and also in naturopathic medicine. The purpose of my testimony today is to compare the pharmacology that we teach in those three branches of medical science. Pharmacology is the study of drugs. We teach how the drugs work. We teach how and when they are to be used. We teach what their side effects are. Pharmacology is the science that healthcare professionals study in preparation for prescribing, administering, and conducting research on pharmaceutical products. The testimony that I wish to deliver today is that the pharmacology that is taught in MD medical schools, in osteopathic medical schools, and in naturopathic medical schools is identical both in quantity, that is the number of contact hours, and intensity, that is the depth with which we study each of the various classes of pharmaceutical products. In addition to teaching pharmacology, I've been permitted to lead colleges of medicine and osteopathic medicine, and even the naturopathic medical school in Portland, Oregon. So I have an overview of not just the instruction in pharmacology, but the instruction that enables that pharmacology to be utilized in healthcare practices. And my purpose for attending and speaking at this session today is to simply make available any expertise that I might have that would enable the members of this committee to determine the wisdom of allowing naturopathic physicians in Alaska to be able to prescribe a broad scope of pharmaceutical products for the care of their patients. And that concludes my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Dr. Jensen. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you. We'll move on to Dr. Sean Higgins. Dr. Higgins, it says you are here in person. Oh, online. Okay.
Yep.
Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you to the chair and committee. My name is Sean Higgins. I'm an ER physician, MD, working in the ER here at Alaska Regional Hospital. Before becoming an Alaskan, I worked in several medical communities in Washington State where licensed naturopathic doctors are permitted to work with a much broader scope that better represents their skill set and training. It's no secret that we are having a major shortage and several barriers to patient access to primary care here in this state. Patients are unable to be seen by their primary care doctors within a timely fashion in many cases, and it's resulting in more trips to the emergency room for primary care-related issues. I would guess, as an ER doctor, I'm probably seeing more and more patients come in for things that should be managed by their primary care doctors, including medication refills, antibiotics for urinary tract infections, contraception, management of chronic conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, as well as small office procedures such as laceration repairs and skin biopsies and small things like that. In the course of a typical shift, I would guess that around 30% of what I'm doing is probably primary care rather than related to emergency medical issues. This not only equates to expensive and unnecessary bills for the patient, but it is putting a huge strain on our staffing and resources in the emergency room and in the hospital. Our wait times have increased tremendously since my time being here, and patients with true emergencies are not always getting the prompt attention they need. I would also additionally argue that it's forcing ER doctors like myself to practice on the fringes of or even outside of our scope of practice and providing primary care, something that NDs may be more well adept at handling than we are. Patients receiving primary care in the ER are, it seems to me like it's a disservice in terms of lack of consistency and follow-up. This is not in alignment with the goal and principles of primary care and the management of chronic illness, and all detrimental to the patient and to Alaska. In my mind, allowing naturopathic doctors to practice to the extent of their training will increase the number of primary care providers in Alaska and give patients more access to their primary care. And hopefully that will keep the emergency room free for true emergencies. I've had many professional working relationships with naturopathic providers from Alaska and Washington. And as we've just heard, these providers have all completed rigorous training, 4 years bachelor program with the same pre-medical requirements I had. The curriculum in their medical school after that for the next 4 years is also mirrors very closely what we learned. The curriculum for that four-year program sounds like in pharmacology may even be identical, which is sort of the matter that we're talking about at hand. So I actually know these providers use the same books and texts for studying for their boards, exams, and licensing exams as I did in terms of pharmacology. I've witnessed my naturopathic colleagues utilize their ability to manage prescriptive medications and perform minor office procedures safely and effectively in Washington. And I'm somewhat baffled in Alaska here that the naturopathic providers need to refer their patients to PA or NP colleagues for medication management, when I know that naturopathic doctors have more rigorous and lengthy training than their mid-level counterparts. Naturopathic doctors do a great job of emphasizing prevention, thus reducing the compliance of chronic disease that lead to emergencies such as heart attacks and strokes. And in my experience, naturopathic doctors are thoughtful, deliberate, and forward-thinking. So by allowing naturopathic doctors to practice to the full extent of their training, you're helping Alaskans receive the primary and preventative care they need, keeping them healthier out of the emergency room. Thank you, Chair and Committee. I'm available for any questions you might have this time.
Thank you, Dr. Higgins. Are there any questions from members of the committee? No? Okay, seeing none, we'll move along. Dr. Rob Downey, you can hear me. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rob Downey calling in from Homer. Is my audio adequate?
We can hear you, Dr. Downey, but perhaps speak a little bit louder.
Maybe a little better with the receiver. Is this clear?
Yes, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. I want to thank the chair and the committee for the privilege of commenting today, and want to thank naturopathic doctors for the terrific work that they do. I've had the privilege of working with them for 17 years, so it's quite a privilege to get to speak on behalf of them, getting to do the work that they're qualified to do today. I want to start by saying that licensed naturopathic doctors are properly trained to prescribe medication in the primary care setting and to do minor procedures, and I recommend that House Bill 115 be passed for that reason. I wanted to, for the purposes of clarity, point out that I'm not a naturopathic doctor, and like November, I'm a medical doctor, and like Mike, and so I'm commenting from the part of the healthcare community that sometimes objects to naturopathic doctors having these privileges, And I think in some ways that makes me better qualified to comment on why they should have these privileges. In terms of why I feel qualified to comment, I have 23 years as an attending physician, as a board-certified family practice MD, and also 17 years in my secondary training as a functional medicine provider, Institute for Functional Medicine Certified Practitioner, which is a lot like naturopathic medicine for MDs. And then I've also been an administrator, so I was the medical director of Seldovia Village Tribe Health and Wellness here in Homer, and I was the assistant long-term care director on South Peninsula Hospital's long-term care unit. Two naturopathic doctors that I've worked with day in and day out at the point of care, discussing cases, making decisions together, include Dr. Daly, who is also my natural medicine mentor in Montana, and Dr. Abby Lang, who many participants in this conversation know as a naturopathic physician here in Alaska. These two brilliant women represent the height of professionalism, clinical discernment, and deep humanity. And they bring the same things to the conversation that I respect about any of my medical provider colleagues in terms of when medications should be used, when referrals should be made to specialists. It's also worth noting there's some irony in the question of withholding these privileges, given that naturopathic doctors tend to be more careful about the use of medication and thus avoid medication errors and frivolous use of meds. So the good news, I think, is that when naturopathic doctors are allowed to prescribe medications in the primary care setting and do minor procedures, we're going to address a profound problem in Alaska, which I've witnessed in over a decade of work here, starting back in 2000. Only 35% of our existing need for primary care is being met by existing Alaskan doctors. And I'd like for all of us to stop and think about that 65% of unmet need. These are our neighbors. These are our friends. These are our families. These are our community members. I just want to briefly present a couple of vignettes. Think about a woman who is philosophically aligned with wanting to see a naturopathic doctor and has high blood pressure. Realistically, as has been noted today, she may not go to another setting to get the medication, but if it can be prescribed by the naturopathic physician, the necessary medication will be prescribed, the blood pressure will be kept down, and that person won't be disabled by a stroke in the future. Or think of a child, again, a vignette that's already been pointed to today. If there's another visit for treatment for an eardrum that's infected, that visit often doesn't happen and the eardrum ruptures. If and when, and I hope it's time now that this legislation passes, necessary antibiotic will be used and that child's suffering and subsequent disability will be prevented. Last but not least, and perhaps some of the best news of all, I understand why members of the conventional medical community tend to be alarmed by change, because the culture of the medical doctor group is philosophically conservative and tends to feel safest protecting the status quo. In this particular instance, that isn't good enough. We're leaving needs unmet, and we're failing to match available resources with qualified providers with a profoundly unmet need. Thankfully, those same individuals now who are not advocating for this change will be relieved and pleased in the future to see the great service that these wonderful providers bring to our fellow Alaskans. So in closing, just want to say that I think it's time for our licensed naturopathic doctors to go ahead with the ability to prescribe medication in the primary care setting that they're trained for and do minor procedures. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Downey. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay. Thank you. And we'll move along to Dr. Scott Looper. Dr. Looper, If you're on, can you please put your name on the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony today. I'm Dr. Scott Looper. I'm a naturopathic doctor who practices in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I've been practicing for just about 30 years. The passage, actually, I wanted to address any loose questions, and the only one that I is a little bit loose is the question that came earlier about Representative Sadler about supervision that naturopathic students receive. About Wiggins, Dr. Wiggins did a pretty good job answering that. I just want to make it clear that the students don't have a license to practice, so they're not able to actually practice legally. They need to. They're required to practice under the license of a licensed physician. Those physicians are largely naturopathic. They occasionally, the students will do rotations in hospitals or emergency rooms or other clinics, and sometimes the supervising physicians will be MDs or DOs or nurse practitioners or other people. So there is a fairly broad experience and exposure that these students receive. Again, in their practices, particularly in the fourth year, their practices, even though they're managing their cases, they're ordering tests, they're doing all that stuff, they're being supervised and they're practicing legally under the supervising physician. So I want to conclude the testimony today and kind of go over a couple of key points. The passage of House Bill 115 will bring the practice of naturopathic medicine in Alaska into congruence with the training that naturopathic doctors receive in school. You've heard testimony today that the naturopathic doctors are trained to provide primary care, and Alaska needs primary care doctors. You've also heard testimony that the care of naturopathic doctors, that the care they provide is competent, conscientious, and safe. And the fact is the safety record of naturopathic medicine is reflected in the low rate of complaints across the nation, and also in the low cost of malpractice insurance for naturopathic doctors in licensed states nationwide. Opposition to the bill is coming primarily from the Alaska State Medical Association. And I want to point out that each of the following professions, physician assistants, optometrists, nurse practitioners, doctors of osteopathy, DOs, and pharmacists, have all been in the position that naturopathic doctors are in today. They've each stood against the opposition of state medical associations in trying to be able to practice like they were trained. And each of these professions have added to the healthcare environment in ways that benefit the public at large. I urge you to pass House Bill 115. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Looper. Are there any questions from any members of the committee? No? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Representative Prox, in closing, did you have any comments?
Thank you, Chair Sumner, and thank you to the committee for your indulgence putting in the time with this. It's an important bill. It's an important consideration. We are dealing with someone's health, and we've done quite a bit of work investigating claims. There's quite a bit of documentation on basis as far as statistics of complaints and et cetera. And then the qualifications that they have to go through, the accreditation. I encourage you to review that. I think it could be a significant help to the community to have more providers being able to provide to the full extent of their training for family care. That's a real gap that it appears in our medical system in the state. So I encourage you to, if you have questions, get with me so that we want this thoroughly vetted, but I think it's time to pass this and let the naturopaths practice to the extent of their training. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Prox. And we will set House Bill 115 aside. The And deadline again is noticed for January 8th, and anticipate taking this bill up the first week of session for amendments and possible reporting out from committee. Take a brief at ease. We are back on the record. Next on the agenda is House Bill 100 from Representative Armstrong. This is the second bill hearing on House Bill 100, which we heard during the last legislative session in Juneau. Representative Armstrong and staff, please put your names on the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Sumner, and thank you to members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee for having us today. For the record, my name is Jenny Armstrong, and I represent House District 16.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong.
The bill we are discussing today is House Bill 100, which is a bill establishing a paid family leave program in Alaska. This will be a powerful tool for making Alaska the best place to raise and care for a family, and it can help with many of the issues we face regarding our economy and public and private sector workforce. I know that the problems we face in Alaska are top of mind for many of us, which includes the fact that families are struggling and our workforce is barely hanging on. Alaska is already a cost-prohibitive place to raise a family, and if you throw in the added difficulties of finding childcare and not having any paid leave, it makes it that much harder to look around and see Alaska as a place where you want to stay or come to if you want to have a family. Couple this with Alaska being a place with high incidence of infant and maternal mortality, and you can see how we are failing our families in many ways. This, of course, impacts our workforce, with recruitment and retention issues ubiquitous in Alaska, especially in state government. Slides 3 through 17 in this slide deck are ones that we left in here from our first hearing, and I won't be going through them today as we want to focus on introducing version B of the bill, but I wanted to include them here for reference. So it includes background on postpartum, early childhood development, why that those early days and months are so important, history of paid family leave, and it covers a number of a lot of data and information on how paid family leave supports families, infants, parents, businesses, dependents, and our state. So that brings us to today. The December 2023 Alaska Department of Labor Economic Trends Report confirmed that in 2022, we had our 10th straight year of net out-migration. We know from prior years that this is particularly pronounced among young professionals and those who would generally be starting and raising young families. On average, employers spend approximately 21% of a position's salary recruiting new candidates for each job. Alaska Economic Trends also recently reported that there are almost two jobs for every available worker in Alaska. As our economy works to recover from the pandemic, and as we work to find a vision for what our state can look like for decades to come, the question we ask ourselves is how can we empower families, private employers, and our public workforce and make this a win-win-win for everyone? A little bit of a background. Until 1993, there was no federal or national policy regarding paid family leave. The American Family Medical Leave Act established a job-protected absences for federal employees and employers with over 50 employees for 12 weeks. The result is that we effectively established unpaid family leave then. The Alaska Family Medical Leave Act established 18 weeks of unpaid leave, which is essentially job-protected absences for public employees. Paid family leave is a well-studied and well-regarded policy that allows young families to grow and thrive without suffering economic hardship. By providing paid family leave, we know that we can ensure that infants are more likely to get follow-up appointments, mothers are less likely to suffer from postpartum depression, and fathers are better able to bond with their family. In California alone, fathers filed no less than 44% of the child bonding claims last year. The National Partnership for Women and Families estimates if women in Alaska participated in the labor force at the same rate as women in countries with paid leave, there would be an estimated 8,000 additional workers in the state and $313.8 million in more wages earned statewide. The average Alaskan worker who takes 4 weeks of unpaid leave loses approximately $3,800 in income. A policy like this would help get all parents back to work and ensure stable family households where both parents are involved in creating a healthy and successful family environment. In 2021, there were virtually no paid family leave industry policy products available beyond individual employers. In just a few short years, we now have every single state in the country with legislation that has been passed, has been implemented, or is in the process. If it were not for this bill being introduced earlier this year, Alaska would have been the only state on this map that did not have something passed or in the works. Many states are already ahead of us. 10 states have approved and have active paid family leave programs. 8 more provide these benefits to state employees. 6 more have passed legislation but have not yet implemented it. That's 24 states who are already ahead of us in terms of recruiting and retaining residents and state workers. With all other states pursuing these policies right now, Alaska cannot afford to be left behind. If we adopt this paid family leave policy, we can start advertising and recruiting people to move to Alaska while also helping to reverse the trend of Alaskans who are leaving. We have an aging population and, as mentioned, an extremely competitive labor market with not enough workers to fill the openings. This could be a powerful tool for growing our economy. Other states run the gamut when it comes to their policy approaches, from plans for state employees only, private sector employer mandates, and completely voluntary plans. The new version of this bill, HB 100 version B, expands coverage opportunities with a lighter footprint by lowering the cost and burden to the state. We are able to do this by replacing a dollar-for-dollar wage replacement with a comprehensive insurance premium paid for by the state. It would establish a paid family leave policy that is optional for private or non-state public employees, like cities and school districts, or public corporations. It provides flexibility and range for employers. They would be allowed to contract with a provider through an insurance pool that establishes beneficial rates based off of the state premium. Employers can still establish their own range and policy, but the intent here is to provide a floor and a starting point and ensure wide accessibility. And similar to other insurance pools, the larger the pool and uptake, the lower the rate. Short-term disability policies provide a readily adaptable model for paid family leave, so when it comes to wage replacement, running premium payments through payroll deductions, et cetera, that framework already exists for employers to be able to offer this. And many vendors who would bid on paid family medical leave can also administer the program, which means we have all the industry expertise at the ready. Above all, the bill as written would place Alaska as one of the best places to raise or care for a family by providing one of the best paid family leave plans in the country. As in version A of HB 100, our goal is to carry over the current Alaska family leave plan into a paid family leave program. Version B lets us carry that into optional voluntary plans for the private market. So this is what it covers. 18 weeks is already what's allowed for job-protected absences for public employers and state government, and that would go from unpaid to paid. It also outlines 6 to 18 weeks for employees of political subdivisions, like boroughs, school districts, et cetera, 6 to 12 weeks for enrolled employees of a participating private employer, and 6 weeks for an employee enrolled through the purchasing pool. This last one is amazing because it means that every individual worker in the state would have the ability to opt into this plan. Wage replacement is capped at no more than $3,000 a week. The range gives employers flexibility with how they want to implement this plan in their own organization or company. $3,000 was picked because in our Department of Labor report for Q3 2023, average monthly state wages were $6,000 a month. It is similar or higher for federal government and resource extraction industries. This effectively conforms to the goal of 100% wage replacement and establishes a cap. By going higher, we also wanted to find a way to ensure another incentive for the private market to opt into the plan using a rate calculated on the state premium. Eligible uses for this, the eligibility in this bill is also largely the same as the existing Alaska Family Leave Act. An employer must have been employed by a company or employer for at least 35 hours a week for 6 weeks or 17 and a half hours a week for 12 months. Or 17 and a half hours a week for 12 months immediately preceding the leave that they take. Eligible uses for this, which is already covered under the Alaska Family Leave Act, is pregnancy, birth of a child, placement of a child. This includes biological, adopted, foster child, stepchild, or a legal ward, caring for a seriously ill child, spouse, or parent with a serious health condition, the employee's own serious health condition, or caring for a child who is over 18 years of age but who is unable to care for themselves because of physical or mental disability. Because this bill establishes a state policy through an insurance product, it explicitly allows the vendor to extend the insurance product to a wider pool of Alaskan employers and the entire private sector on an optional basis. Other states that have already allowed private employers to voluntarily offer this kind of product include Arkansas, Alabama, Texas, Florida, Tennessee, and Virginia. Similar to roads and highways, we must invest to get results. we do not often have the ability for widespread public investment in an individual household. This bill will give employers and communities the ability to voluntarily build that infrastructure using familiar methods. The bottom line is that this would give Alaskan families the resources to care for their loved ones through existing processes and industries using methods that every employer already knows how to administer. When we look at other states, their models vary widely. Some require employer mandates, some require fees and other large state investments, and some are more coercive or voluntary than others. Here we chose a model that has a light footprint and a wide reach. Version A of our bill required large state investment and only covered government employees, while a substantial pool, that reach was necessarily limited. Version B establishes a wider pool through an economic incentive that is voluntary for private employers and has the lightest footprint to the state as well. This version of the bill can reach a much larger percentage of Alaskan families and employers of all sizes. We believe this is the most affordable practical benefit we can provide to state employees and to our wider economy as a whole, and of course, the best benefit for our children. We are now happy to walk you through a sectional analysis if that would be useful, or answer any questions that you have. And thank you again so much for your time today.
Sure. Representative Armstrong, why don't you proceed with your sectional analysis, and then we will take questions.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. It's a long sectional, but just for the public edification, I'll go through it if that's the committee as well. And so I just don't want to bore you all to death, but we'll start. So section one is establishing the Alaska Paid Family Leave Plan. And so it adds a new section of law to Alaska Statutes 2310. So AS 2310-700A instructs the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development and the Commissioner of Administration to jointly procure a paid family leave insurance plan, define which employees may be eligible to use it, and how they are entitled to participate. AS 2310-700E mandates that the procurement process will be governed by the State of Alaska Procurement Code. 700C provides for the evaluation of the responses for that procurement and requires to be filed with the Director of Insurance for approval. 700D specifies the parameters of the plan adopted by both departments must include length and time of open enrollment, enrollment processes for various eligible employees, and how premiums will be paid or deducted. 700E directs the Commissioners of Administration and Labor and Workforce Development to adopt procedures for collection of information and premiums from covered employees and the transmission of such to the insurer, and penalties for late payments, how they will be calculated. 710A specifies wage replacement for eligible employees and how to calculate the average weekly wage for those employees. 710B specifies the maximum allowable family leave eligible employees may take. It states the plan may not impose any minimum duration. 710C sets employment eligibility requirements for covered employees. 720A states that a political subdivision of the state or private employer may opt into the paid family leave plan established under this section. It states that these entities shall contract directly with the insurer and provide for parameters on their participation in the plan. 720E requires that any premium charged by the insurer to the political subdivision or private employer must be actuarially justified and derived from the state employee premium. 720C states that an employee of a participating employer, local subdivision, may choose to enroll in the plan. 720D states that a participating political subdivision or private employer pay premiums directly to the insurer and they may do so via payroll deductions. 720E states that a participating employer with 50 or more employees maintain coverage in a group health plan for level and conditions the employee had stayed at work. It requires them to restore the employee to the same or reasonably same role after returning to work, declares that they may not retaliate or discriminate against the employee if they take paid family leave. This section effectively carries over requirements of the National Family Medical Leave Act. 720F states that a participating employer with fewer than 50 employees may collect and transmit the premiums directly to the insurer of the purchasing pool premium account. It states that they need to deduct the premiums from payroll deductions via payroll deductions. 730A establishes the purchasing pool premium account and requires the insurer to participate in it. 730B allows an employee of a political subdivision or private employer that does not participate in family leave plan or a substantially similar family leave benefit to the employees to contract directly with the insurer via the purchasing pool. 730C allows that the pool may be experienced as rated. This section establishes a waiting period, an elimination period, as well as open enrollment processes. It caps the coverage premiums at $5 a week. 730D states that the private employer or political subdivision of the state with 50 or more employees whose employee participates in the purchasing pool transfer that employee's premium directly to their insurer by a payroll deduction. An employer with less than 50 employees may pay those premiums directly to the purchasing pool. 730E requires the Commissioner of Administration to separately account for the personal assumed pool premium payments received by the department and for payment of the premiums to ensure participating in the family leave insurance plan purchasing pool premium account. 740A establishes the purchasing pool premium stabilization account. It requires the Commissioner of Administration to account separately for premium taxes on family leave insurance plan appropriations made from purchasing pool stabilization and gifts, grants, and donations made for the purchase of stable for the purpose of stabilizing the purchasing pool. 740B allows the legislature to appropriate funds of the purchasing pool so that premiums do not exceed $5 per week. This is based off the New Hampshire statute. 750A establishes the Family Leave Insurance Advisory Board to support the Commission of Administration in implementing and administering paid family leave insurance plans. 750B directs the composition of the Family Leave Insurance Advisory Board. 750C requires the advisory board to meet at least quarterly. 760 requires that the provisions of AS 2310, 700 through 790 are not subject to collective bargaining. 770A requires the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, in conjunction with Department of Administration, to prepare and submit a report to the legislature on the use of paid family leave by January 15th of each year. 770B directs the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to work in conjunction with the Department of Administration to develop an outreach program to educate workers, families, and employers on the benefits of participation in the paid family program. 780 directs that the commissioners of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the Commission of Administration may issue regulations to implement that chapter. 790 is the definition section for terms specific to AS 2310, 700 through 790. Then that's section one. Section two is conforming changes. So it works on chapter 39, which is public employees and employees pay and compensation. So to start, 305A is amended to allow an employee of the state to take paid family leave. This is a conforming change. The state may not require the employee to substitute accrued paid leave, which the employee is entitled. Section three establishes parameters for the paid family leave plan for state employees, and under it, AS 3920-500B amended to reflect that state employees are entitled to paid family leave. Because the political subdivision may choose to opt in or not, an employee of a political subdivision may opt into a program under that chapter, and as such, an employer is not allowed to require the employee to substitute accrued paid leave. It also establishes that eligible reasons to take paid family leave include pregnancy, birth of a child, placement of a child, caring for a child, spouse, or parent with a serious health condition, and the employee's own serious health condition. Section 4 makes conforming changes to Title 39, Chapter 20, to reflect the ongoing employment of the employee. And so AS 3920-500D is amended to delete the reference to unpaid leave, which is the prior policy or the current policy. Section 5 establishes a conforming change again because the policy is offered outright to all state employees. AS 3920-500F is amended to include political subdivisions of the state, and this is a conforming change to make sure that if a political subdivision did decide to provide the benefit, their staff would be covered. Section 6, again, is conforming changes. AS 3920-552 is amended to make conforming changes to the definition of employer. And then Section 7 establishes a paid family leave tax credit for eligible taxpayers that provide these benefits. Similar to New Hampshire, that is 50% of the premium paid by the taxpayer each year when they offer this benefit. And so you can see that creating a new section, AS 4320-75. And finally, Section 8 provides for a transition date and implementation of the Alaska Paid Family Leave Plan. Thank you.
Thank you. And are there questions from committee members? Representative Fox?
Thank you. It is detailed. You are correct. Thank you. In a nutshell, I just want to confirm my understanding of that. As I understand it, the state would be required to provide the coverage political subdivisions can choose to opt in, and companies with more than 50 employees are required to participate in the program. For the record, to the chair, for the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, to the chair, Representative Fox, it is optional for all employers in the state other than the state itself. And so a political subdivision and a private employer would both, it would be optional entirely regardless of the size. However, there are still requirements that private employers over 50 employees, they must still follow the Alaska Family, or sorry, the Federal Family Medical Leave Act. And so there are some forming changes in here that touch on employers over 50.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Have you done, or is there a plan to do some sort of actuarial analysis on this as it applies to Alaska?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff Representative Armstrong. To the chair, Representative Prox, we are discussing with outside groups doing like a cost-benefit analysis, but this bill would require it to be based, actuarially based, and so that's where any of the vendors would be able to successfully bid on this sort of contract with the state of Alaska would already be doing that sort of due diligence, and that's where effectively, in terms of their policies that they already offer, they're doing that sort of work when it comes to like short-term disability. And in here, effectively, they would be simply looking at what the state pool would look like, what possible, if a private employer would opt in, they would actuarially base that rate based on the employer's own workforce. And so when we look at other states, there was some news coverage talking about small businesses that had opted in with the New Hampshire plan. And so there's one small business that had paid about $3,000 to give this benefit under New Hampshire statute for 29 employees. And so that's where the plan will be actuarially based and will be modified for any private employer that decides to offer this benefit. And they'll be working directly with the provider of the state to calculate that.
And I don't want to hog it, but thank you. Through the chair, the benefit is based on the just number of people, and an employer that might have a couple of dozen, or let's call it 49. They are not penalized. They just become part of a larger pool with the state. Is that correct?
Through the chair?
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
There are any other questions from committee members? Representative Fox.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, for the sake of discussion, let's say that an employer or a political subdivision elects not to participate. Can an employee on their own become part of the program?
Through the chair, yes. So we're going to have an individual purchasing pool, so this makes this available to pretty much all working parents or anybody, any worker in the state of Alaska. They can just join the larger purchasing pool.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, how much would it cost for someone to buy into it? Did you figure it out yet?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, I can give you a little bit of illustration for what other states. When we have this very colorful slide on slide 18 or so, you can see the various other states that have put this together. And keep in mind that other states do definitely have, for example, larger workforces. Others are only applying these to their state employee work pool versus the private market at large. That's where I believe Hawaii offers their plan for $7 a week, and that's something that's more of a short-term disability plan. Washington State is $2 a week. New Hampshire's is $5. So that's where the contract with the provider will help determine the cost of the large employer would pay. And the interesting thing that New Hampshire's done is that they work to try to make sure that that benefits the private market for the state.
All right. Thank you, Representative Armstrong. Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m.